Woven questions about how the church is impacted by the culture that we live in now, how it's different now than it was, for example, when I became a Christian, or what are the challenges now in the work that we try to do together that are different from what they were like when I first got to start working with the congregation. How things are going to be for my children and grandchildren as they now are going along in their lives, and how do elders, preachers, members of congregation try to plan a way of going about our work in the setting where it is right now. And I'm concerned with how to help us in our thinking and the cultural setting where we are to be able to just be faithful Christians, but I'm concerned also about how we present the message of the gospel, how we even make contact with people so as to be able to have a conversation with them. You know, here we are at one time in a world where we could say, if we could get a Bible study with someone, we could sit down and look for what the Lord says and try to reason about it. And now then, it might look like predominantly like, well, who's to say whether anything's right at all or whether it even matters? I mean, that's how we're dealing with things now. So I've been thinking about something that I want to start with us tonight, and I'm just going to refer to it as our one another work. And it kind of dawns on me that the Lord has asked His people, He always has asked His people to do some things that are by nature going to call for a healthy congregational life and basically a program of work if we are doing these things. And so that's kind of where we're headed with this. I'd like to start, though. How would you define culture? And you notice in your paper I've left blanks and there's something. How would you define culture? If you just, maybe your mind is more in tune with this screen over here than this. So how would you define culture if I ask you that? What do we mean by culture? I'm not talking about cultured, like, you know, being well brought up and having had all these experiences, all that. Bill?
The way we live.
The way we live. That's a good definition, especially the way we all live all together. Julie?
Society's
way of doing things. So how society lives. I've put some definitions on your paper there, but think about this one. This is just Webster's definition. The integrated pattern of human knowledge, belief, and behavior. And I would use the word maybe the predominant integrated pattern. The customary beliefs and social forms. Or a third phrase, the set of shared attitudes, values, goals, and practices. Which leads to questions about American culture right now of what is shared. And that makes us stop and think about that. The culture then is the setting in which we have to try to live and bring up our families and do our work for the Lord. And is it more like Daniel in Babylon, or is it more like Paul in Rome? Or aren't those both just alike, and aren't those in some ways what things are like for the Lord's people then or now? Have the Lord's people ever had the advantage of just living in a culture which completely shared our values and our ways of behaving and our thoughts. Have the Lord's people found it necessary to be in a majority in a culture in order for the Lord's people to do their work? I don't think so, Jim. I will say that I'm talking more about the world we live in than I am the church in this matter. But the culture we live in values doing something as if it had merit in it because it's the first time, or that's different, or that's not what was before. That's the culture we live in. That's the challenge we have when we talk about things that are changeless then. So how would you describe the culture around us right now then? Don't look at what I have on your paper there yet. How would you describe the culture? I mean, I'm not talking about necessarily in your neighborhood only, but when you watch TV, when you look at the news, when you follow education or entertainment, which, by the way, that's where the predominant customs of thinking, believing, behaving are communicated. How would you describe the culture we live in? All right, Eddie said it's a culture of what's best for me. Very much, what do I get out of it? It's an individual. Individually based, and that would become the measure of everything. Can you think of other ways you describe it, Gene?
I have to just do what somebody else does.
All right, just do whatever other. We let someone else set the tone, and we follow whatever seems to be the consensus. Anything goes, Julie says. And you put those things together, they don't actually fit together very well, do they? But that describes the situation. Dennis?
Just before I turned off TV, and I can't give you the quote of the person, but he said, in this world today, you must believe in something, even if you don't believe at all.
Yeah, and very often, don't believe at all. That's very much a picture of it. Just choose what you believe based on what you want to, you know, that kind of thing. No firm value. So I look at it, I've looked at the trail of ways of describing the predominant culture over the last, two centuries plus, we'd say, in Western thought especially. The modernism, I'll just give you some of the defining characteristics of these. Modernism thought the ultimate reality is basically the natural world, nature. That man is basically a higher order animal. Modernism believed in the inherent goodness of man. Man means well, and he'll make things. And then the inevitability of progress. That's modernism. Now, some small things happen, like two world wars and tragedies all around, like that kind of thing. And so we move to the so-called postmodern world. The postmodern world in more recent times has had a number of characteristics that you may have heard discussions about over time. Most of the postmodern thought was more no objective reality, more pessimistic, more the idea that we can argue about things because there's no measure of any reality besides preference, that kind of thing. Joke everything off, take nothing seriously, don't think about what death. And then more recently, I've found these terms. One writer uses late in parentheses, late modern, or another writer uses postmodern to describe the situation now. And the postmodern thought is the idea that let me read you a definition I found from Nathan Guy at Harding about this, and it'll get across what I'm getting at. The postmodern thought, we might, he says, we're now entering an era where a clearly defined set of cultural values are held as sacrosanct. In other words, there are none. There are no defining cultural values. And dissenting voices are judged as wrong or even malicious simply for challenging the controlling narrative. You become a Nazi or some sort of ism or ist simply for having a conviction about something that's accepted that certain segments want to be successful. And so the time is now called the post-Christian era is the one that we're now hearing. Because, you see, if, as I've just read, those who don't subscribe, those who offer a dissenting voice about a behavior or a belief or a political view or whatever else are in the wrong. And if you are someone who believes there is one of anything, God or Lord or Spirit or body, or if there is a right and wrong behavior that does not arise within the right or wrongness does not arise in the individual preference, then that's the so-called post-Christian era. As a Christian, how does that make you feel? And then I raise the question this way. Does the state of the culture concern you for the church, for your faith, for our work as Christians? And if it does concern you, how does it concern you? When you're a Christian and you're told that we now live in the post-Christian era, how does it make you feel with regard to the future growth of the church? How does it? What do you think? What, Eddie?
When we try to tell someone our beliefs, they think we're narrow-minded. They think that we have no reason to have any right to criticize what they're
doing. So does that mean that the day of evangelism is over? Are you concerned that we're headed for a situation or that we've arrived at one where it's fine for you to have your beliefs and be a Christian if that's what you want, but just don't say anything about it? Jerry?
I'm concerned about Adam and his ability to do anything with the modern young person.
All right.
That directs them toward a future of Christianity.
All right. Jerry said he's concerned about working with young people and communicating to young people anything about behavior or about belief or about being corrected by God's will on anything. All right. Anybody else?
My biggest concern is that the secular world is taking big steps as comparison with us. We don't seem to.
All right. Luis said he is concerned that the secular world seems to be making big steps toward influence, and we don't seem to be. Okay, anybody else? I'm not trying to discourage us. I'm trying to set this discussion in its place, and so you'll know where we're coming from if what we want to try to study over this quarter. So you can see that we have a life situation where there are certain challenges that we deal with, and we wonder how is a good way to approach this, to impact it, and to make a difference in it, as the Lord expects us to do. So what we might, there are some things we might remember here to start with, and I'd like to share these thoughts with our class here. First off, our faith, it's important for us to remember to have a broader view of things than just the last 150 years in America. Our faith spread and succeeded and became strong in a pre-Christian culture. I found something that Stan Mitchell over at Fried Hardeman wrote, and I've brought some things from some of the young professors or young preachers, younger guys. I don't know Stan, but he's at Henderson, Tennessee at least. He's writing about this. He says, remember that for its first four centuries, Christianity spread its message in a society that was every bit as hostile to the gospel, just as ignorant of God's ways, and with the religion just as pluralistic as ours is. It is important to remember that, isn't it? When we get to looking too close up just at our setting in American life right now, we lose one of the marks of this these eras that we're talking about is a loss of contact with history, loss of interest in it. Very much a view that if anything is old, it can't be right, it can't be good. So it's important for us to remember this is the kind of world the church was born into. Okay.
Starting to read last night for Thursday morning ladies' class on Hebrews, and that was something that Arthur pointed out, that they believe that Hebrews was written to encourage the Christians because they were going against their culture at the time.
Okay. Hebrews is my favorite New Testament book, so it's a preacher's book, but it's also every Christian's book, and that's one of the reasons right there. All right, so remember that. Now, a second observation. One of the leading reasons why the church succeeded and spread is that Christianity works in relationships. I found this interesting. Somebody writing about the postmodern, late modern, whatever we write about now, says this: postmodern people are searching for community. In this scary world, people are drawn to a community where they might find a sense of significance and identity. Now, if that's what people are looking for, could the church, do we have anything to say to a world like that? Yes. Did you listen to the paragraph John read to us a while ago and about the kind of community? I almost want to ask him to read it again. Romans 12, it had one another in it twice. I was listening for that. And then the way it talks about, and then to broaden it out farther than that, the way the New Testament letters talk about Christians in family life, or Christians in the workplace, or Christians in the state and under government authority. If we are living in an age where people don't talk about whether something's true or false or right or wrong. They're just interested in whether it works. Then the faithful practice of the kind of religion the New Testament calls for would have a needed message for that kind of world. Nathan Guy at Harding writes about the post-Christian era, so-called. He says, in this situation, if we allow authentic, loving behavior to take the lead over verbal critique, then how we live may be the catalyst for further invitation to consider questions of truth. In other words, why do you live like you live? And if we can show that our faith is what turns the corner there, what makes the difference, then that would be a helpful thing. So that's now, what would be the next step to take? It's what I've just been talking about. So a priority for us in our work, in our program of work, if I can say it that way, is cultivating, that is, maintaining a Christian culture in our congregational life. What is the strategy for impacting the culture of the world? It's Christian culture among congregations of the Lord's people. And if we this would be a positive approach to having a voice in the world now. Okay, Luis.
So can we say culture is born from example?
I think what I'm saying is culture is born more by habits than it is by conscious efforts to be examples.
Imitation, like you imitate, like you say in church, if we create a culture that loves each other, which other people will see, and that
it'll be different. That's what the light of the world and the salt of the earth would be about. I think that's true. And I guess I'm trying to point out that the world has its culture. We live in that. We don't go hide, but there is also a culture within the lives of God's people together that's established by the New Testament or called for by the New Testament. And it's a way of I found this from Justin Rogers over at Fried Hardeman maybe as well, but he's talking about what I'm talking about, but indirectly. He says that creating a healthy Christian culture involves a positive Christian atmosphere. Positivity is infectious, he writes. Spend time with a positive person and you'll find yourself happier, healthier, and more energetic. By contrast, negativity is a cancer that, untreated, will kill a church. If churches aren't careful, they can become hotbeds of negativity. We can focus on the empty seats rather than the filled ones. We can focus on the money we don't have rather than what we do have. We can chastise those who are involved rather than honoring those who are involved. And then discouragement breeds bitterness, and bitterness breeds envy, and that breeds then problems, and that breeds an un-Christian culture in a group of people. So, how do we go about this? And I would suggest, okay, Bill?
I'm saying all of this we've talked about, do not leave God out.
All right, that's all right. So if we're not going to leave God out, then I think it's important to point out the Lord has a plan. And this is this rather than our trying to figure out how what do we do, how we if we start with the Lord has a plan, and it's each one functioning as a member of a local church. Each Christian, each believer in Christ, each person who's in Christ. And it's like, you notice in the pictures of the church in the New Testament, the ones that have to do with how we function, it's like being members of a body like this, where we work together, or it's like being members of a family, where we relate to each other, and we each have work to do. Kelly did a ladies' class the other day. I just looked at her and remembered. She passed along to me what she did, the connections. Like, she works in a department at CU which has to take care of the maintenance of all the vehicles, and she's telling me how many of the problems can involve connections that are not what they should be. She made a very good application of that to our lives with each other, and it has to do with what we're talking about right now. The letter to the church at Philippi is to the saints who are in Christ Jesus at Philippi, or in Philippi, with the bishops and deacons. Saints are God's holy people. The bishops are shepherds or elders who oversee the work. Deacons are ministers or servants, those who engage in ministries or service in a responsible sense. Appointed by the congregation. So this is what we mean by a local church where all the saints are functioning like members of a body or like family members in a household. When each part is working, then the body builds itself up in love, Ephesians 4:16 it says. So that is the plan. Now, what happens then is we say, all right, what's the program for accomplishing that plan? And please understand that I'm not arguing. I, of all people, do not want to discourage involvement in any program or that we as a congregation try to do together. And I'm deeply grateful for all of the work, but the Lord has a program. And I want to suggest to this quarter in this class that the Lord's program for this is the one another work that He assigns to all the members of His body, the one another work. And I wonder if we thought about this a lot. One another. This is the original term, allelon, and it's a reciprocal pronoun, meaning not I'm here and I'm interested in what you can do for me, but you're here too. And I have the same obligations to you that you have to me. All right. That in itself is different from the culture where we live in. That we fall easily in American culture into consumerism, where church life becomes about what the staff does for the members. And where we think unless there is the machinery of a program that is flawlessly planned and pulled off that nobody's ever thought of before in the history of the church, then there's no way we can keep up in the culture like it is now. Where if each member of the body took to heart the one another challenges that there are, the nature of the church would become obvious, and we would have a living, healthy, vibrant interaction with each other that would cause our neighbors to hear us thinking and talking positively about our life in the Lord, and we could begin to see more open doors in that way. This is a term that's used 58 times in the New Testament, about 40 of these by Paul in his letters, and if I count right, encompassing approximately 28 different specific actions. We'll show some of these as we go along in this quarter. These one another passages, how many of them, by the way, can you think of? Love one another would be the most prominent. 16 times, by the way, that one. All right. Anybody, can you think of any others? All right, one accord together. Sometimes the versions in Romans 12 talk about living in harmony with each other in that way. And that's the practices of the golden rule, all of them are. But specifically one another, can you think of any more? One of them involves a holy kiss. Which one's that? Greet one another. Show hospitality to one another. Encourage one another. Don't lie to one another. Build up one another. Bear one another's burdens. That's true, but one another. Now, what are the one another's? Edify, that's build up. There's admonish one another, warn that way. There is the serve one another in love, serve one another. There are a bunch of these different things. So they're all exhortations to specific action in this on your paper there, in the mutual process of building up each other. We think of the Lord's redeeming work. We think of His rule over His people. We think of the Spirit's work in making intercession in our prayers, and then in bearing His fruit in our lives. But the part about our making it to heaven that we can overlook is the mutual process of building each other up. Take what Jerry mentioned a while ago about how we work with our young people and following generations in a world like this. One key thing, and getting them ready to be family members and getting them ready to function as members of the Lord's body, is this: I have an obligation, we have an obligation toward each other, a connection. And building each other up. The meanings of these different exhortations, all the ones that I've mentioned these different times, can be grouped into about a dozen significant actions. And that's the way we're going to try to do this quarter, is I want to try to, in each class, group some of these statements together so that we end up covering each one, but so we can see what kind of an impact we're talking about, and then what will that look like in the life of a group of God's people where some awfully difficult challenges are faced and where sometimes discouraging things happen. And if you think about it, if we apply these actions, then each one of us ends up being involved in a pretty dynamic force in the world, and that's the functioning body of Christ, which overcame from those early days and which still can overcome. Can you imagine the Lord making promises to people, what He would do for them if they overcame and if overcoming was impossible? He stays with His people and He helps us do whatever He gives, whatever He requires of us or asks of us. He gives us the strength to do. So this is something that we could set out to do, and He would help us do because it's what He asked to start with. I'd say it that way. Now, down to here, do you guys have any comments or questions you'd like to insert on this? Have you thought about this as the Lord's program for us accomplishing what He's planned of us? Have you thought about this as an antidote to the impact of the culture on the life and the work of the church? Cultivating a Christian culture by attending to our one another obligations toward each other. Now, just in congregational terms, if you think about it, there are some challenges to this that we have more of now than I remember us having 30-odd years ago when I got here with you guys. One of them is we live farther apart. We're scattered. I mean, from where Jerry lives to where Brenda and Carol lives is, what would that be, Jerry, from your house to up there past Buffalo, up there, not quite that far, but not to Buffalo on this side of it. But that's a long ways. Another of it is the age differences. And when I first got here, there were a whole bunch of people, Bill's family and Bob's family and Burl and Jenny, and I'm telling how old you guys are here. I hope you don't mind that. Barbara and Van, and people who were, you got Betty and Bob, people who were you guys as friends, and you guys had brought up your kids together, and you guys had done so much wonderful work and good. But we don't come with that already built in our experience. And so that becomes a challenge. And then the ways in which our families are, how many different school districts? I'm not talking about just schools in not just schools in Springfield, but school districts. I wonder how many. I'd say 6 or 7. Maybe more than that even. So it's not like we all go to the same sports events and are on the same PTAs and all that kind of stuff. Now then, we have separate home schools. So how do we get the connectedness of fellowship? Well, let's try this as a renewed emphasis and a starting place for all the rest. Let's try to focus on our one another work. And I'll say this in finishing up here. All of these one another's, of course, can be, as Julie mentioned a moment ago, summed up as or understood as loving one another, which is something our culture talks about a lot without knowing what it's talking about. I have to be quick.
Yeah, I remember 30 years ago, if something happened in the church, you got a personal phone call. We don't do that anymore.
Now, a lot of people do, Julie. A lot of it's posted on Facebook now, or a lot of it's texted, but it's all, it's that's a part of the challenge. It's there, but it somehow doesn't seem as personal. And that's the challenge of almost a third of the uses of our one another word are in passages that are talking about loving one another. And the role this plays in a Christian life, look at 1 Peter, for example, and we'll kind of just end this way. I haven't read a bunch of passages tonight. This is an introductory type of a study. But just think about this now. In 1 Peter 1, having talked about the wonder of being redeemed, Peter says, having purified your souls by your obedience to the truth for a sincere love, brotherly love, love one another earnestly from a pure heart. Earnestly from a pure heart. Now, if I ask you to love one another fervently from a pure heart, and that's all I say, how do you do that? If I can read to us, love one another fervently from a pure heart, and then I can read to us 27 one another's. See, that might give love a shape in our lives. Look at 1 Peter 4 and verse 8. Whoops. 1 Peter 4 and verse 8. Above all, keep loving one another earnestly, since love covers a multitude of sins. Verse 9, show hospitality to one another without grumbling. and there are, of course, many of others of these one another's as we read through this. But all the rest of these exhortations tell us how to do that. So I hope this sounds interesting to you. I hope it'll be something that you'll join us for as we try to think through this New Testament concept, and I hope it looks to us like a bunch of atoms, ATOMS, all interacting with each other and making something alive and vibrant and making it impactful and meaningful in our lives. Thank you guys very much for being with us. My mother is not well right now. Appreciate you guys remembering her in your prayers. And we do have a long list in our bulletin, if you'll please take notice of each one. Before we go tonight, Scott, would you mind to just stand where you are and lead us in a word of prayer, please?